You are listening to episode 9. Hello and welcome to What Leaders Know, the podcast for people on leadership journeys. I'm your host, Penny Beeston. I help people take their leadership to the next level. Learn more at whatleadersknow.com. Today's podcast will be of particular interest to listeners looking to a leadership career within and beyond the armed forces, as well as leaders looking to pivot. My guest today is Garth Callender. If this name sounds familiar to you, you may have seen Garth across the mainstream and social media, or you may have read his book, After the Blast. Garth Callender has travelled a remarkable road, and at the heart of his story is years of formal military training and operational experience in war zones. Garth was the first serious Australian casualty of the war in Iraq, after his armed vehicle was targeted by an insurgent bomb attack. What is remarkable about Garth's story is his ability to overcome both the physical and physiological trauma and redeploy to war zones again and again. After leaving the regular army, Garth wrote the award-winning After the Blast, which chronicled the events in his deployments that make them anything but ordinary. From his highly successful 20-plus year military career, Garth has gone on to excel in both public and private sector roles. He is sought after as a management consultant and non-executive director. His military and business background give him credibility and insights that are rarely found in corporate Australia. Welcome, Garth.
Good afternoon, Penny. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Lovely to have you here. Garth, I begin each interview with this question: why does leadership matter? Given our lives continue to be marked by the uncharted territory of COVID, could you respond in the context of COVID?
Hi, Penny. Yeah, I have to catch myself because I'll start ranting with this sort of stuff because I think leadership is so important right now, you know, more so than a lot of other times in history. I won't say all other times in history, but a lot of other times in history. You know, fundamentally being able to influence others to do things that maybe otherwise they wouldn't ordinarily do. And we've seen that in the range of ways that different governments across the globe and the difference in governments within Australia, the state and federal governments, and their different approaches to leadership and getting people to do things, which otherwise they wouldn't otherwise do. Everything from providing that role model to being frank and open with the general population and dealing with what is in essence in a lot of countries some real tragic events and being able to lead the population as they seek to recover from this. The corporate world and the business world, you know, it's the ability to react to the situation, to lead and protect your organisation. And subtly as well in this environment, it's being able to capitalise on those opportunities as well. So be able to take that step back from the situation and as a leader being able to take that deep breath and make clear-eyed decisions to protect your organisation, your people, your stakeholders.
I guess there's layers and layers of complexities that are new because none of us have actually lived through a pandemic before.
It's so complex. And I deal with a lot of businesses right now who you know, last year had risk registers which had these single line items throughout it, which were about supply chain issues and which were about staffing issues and with about, you know, legislation changes and all these things which would impact on their business. But COVID right now is overlaying all these risks on top of each other, all playing out at once. So it really, we would struggle to find it more complex, yes.
I guess in our conversation, we're going to cover off on some of the complexities, the real complexities of leadership when we talk about leadership in the face of a war zone. But right now, what I'd like to do is to understand your decision as a school leaver to join the armed forces. What were your drivers and where did you vision yourself as you pulled on that uniform of the Australian Army? And did you already have Duntroon in your sights?
So, look, to be frank with that, I joined the Army in the mid-90s and I joined at a time where you could sign up for a year. So, really, the young bloke I was then was really a directionless 18-year-old, who really didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. I definitely didn't see a long-term career in the military. I just thought it would be an interesting opportunity to see what the army's like for 12 months. And yeah, you know, 17 years later, I was still there. And I guess, you know, to probably to better answer your question, maybe if we fast forward through probably to September 11, 2001, which was really, I guess, when the world got serious for my generation. And that's when I, you know, I'd been a soldier. I'd done that for a few years, and then I'd shown some leadership potential and been accepted into Duntroon. And I was in my last 6 months at the college, and in fact, probably the last 3 months at Royal Military College Duntroon when those planes flew into the towers. And I remember thinking, this is going to shape my career. And it absolutely did. You know, two trips to Baghdad and a deployment to Afghanistan, I'm sure wouldn't have happened if that event hadn't occurred.
We all have very different and very unique and individual responses to 9/11, but yours clearly was very influenced by the fact that you were at Duntroon, you were about to emerge as a fully trained leader in the armed forces, the Australian Armed Forces. So what was that like for you? What actually were the things that went through your head around where you saw the world going at that point in time?
I'm going to continue to be frank here. I was a pretty happy-go-lucky soldier, and I was a pretty, you know, happy-go-lucky cadet when I was at the Royal Military College as well, to the point where I bumbled my way through is probably putting it lightly. But I guess that event really was had a sobering effect on me, because I said, look, the world is going to change from this, and I'm going into a leadership role where I'll be commanding soldiers. I don't know what we'll be doing, but this event is serious, and the world has just suddenly overnight got really serious for me. So it was, yeah, it was that slap around which I needed, and yeah, it's really, I guess, gave me focus on what really my career ahead of me had in store.
So if we go ahead to 2004, which was the date of your first deployment to Iraq, when that war was raging, one that would influence and feature in your career trajectory that year. Can you take us through that first deployment?
Yeah, and it's you know, it's good to be talking about this, because to be honest, I've particularly in the last 24 hours, I've been reflecting on this quite a lot, because it's 16 years. Yesterday was 16 years to the day from this event, but of getting injured overseas. But to set the scene, so I was been out of Duntroon 2 years. I was a young lieutenant in the cavalry, and I took a group of about 25 soldiers to Baghdad, running the armoured vehicle troop, so 7 18-wheeled, 13-ton armoured vehicles, which were used for protecting the diplomatic staff, so the Australian embassy staff in Baghdad, and allowing them to carry out the diplomatic function in the sort of greater Baghdad area. So we'd been through quite a lot of training. We'd been through months of training on top of our normal conventional sort of style training. We'd done Baghdad-specific training, and we deployed in early September. Very long, busy days in a city of 7 million people all just trying to get on with their lives while a civil war really raged around them. And my guys were out on the road sort of all day, every day. And if you look at it from a risk perspective, we were exposing ourselves to a lot of risk. We knew that basically there were bombs going off all day, every day, targeting coalition patrols like us, Iraqi army and police patrols, private security patrols, killing hundreds of people, in fact, thousands of people, and we would have multiple events like this every day where soldiers were being killed, but also there was a lot of innocent people being killed in this as well. So we're operating in that environment where the likelihood of an event was very high. These events were happening every day, and the consequence, which we saw firsthand numerous times, was catastrophic. You know, we knew if a bomb went off near us, we would likely be very badly injured or killed, as well as the diplomats who were there to protect. So, maybe we can talk about this as we progress, but, you know, from that risk perspective, things were operating in the red, and I guess 2 months into the deployment, our luck really ran out. And 8 o'clock in the morning on the 25th of October, I was commanding a two-vehicle patrol into the heart from our forward operating base into the heart of Baghdad to drop off a few people, pick a few people up, and then a few more tasks for that day. But we've got about 600 metres from the front gate of our compound and a car that had been the previous night parked on the side of the road had an explosive, probably some artillery rounds in the back, hooked up to a radio-controlled detonator or trigger. And as we drove past that car, it was likely an insurgent trigger man was watching down on us from one of the high-rise apartment blocks around the area and detonated the device as we went past. So it was it went off probably within about 5 metres of me and the vehicle. There were three of us in the vehicle. As the commander, I was standing up. I had my head and neck exposed and copped a fair degree of the heat and the blast from that bomb. Now I could probably rabbit on all afternoon about this, but there was some really it's a defining point of my career. Absolutely, it gave me a perspective on risk. It gave me a perspective on leadership, and it really what we saw that day. I was badly injured, but actually, if you take that step back, there were at least three people killed in that bomb blast, and they were locals in the area. Two of them were children. The children that used to wave at us every time we drive past. If we're talking about September 11 being one of those moments of clarity in what the world had in store, that event gave me an understanding of the world and the way different people operate. You know, I probably went over there a bit undercooked in my thoughts on the adversaries who were facing. I grew up in suburban Sydney, beautiful, peaceful Australia. Anyone with any kind of homicidal tendencies has probably already been locked up. Whereas we went into a war zone where, at the time, they talk about the fact that there were anything up to 40,000 active insurgents. And it really didn't click in my mind, firstly, that there were 40,000 people who would go out of their way to kill me, but also the idea that a lot of, I guess, probably a lot of young men have, which is that even when bad things are happening, they don't think that bad things are going to happen to them. So it was, it gave me a real opportunity to grow and learn. You know, it's definitely not how I'd recommend that other people do it, but it was definitely one of those opportunities for me.
Can I just ask you about your injuries and your recovery? I understand you were the first Australian soldier to be injured in the Iraq War, seriously injured.
I've got to be honest, I was extraordinarily lucky. You know, I did work after this in the counter-improvised explosive device space at the strategic level, and I saw a lot of reports and even Afghanistan went to a lot of sites where there'd been smaller bombs, people had been further away, and they'd fared far worse than I did. So I was extraordinarily lucky. I had second-degree burns to my face and neck, and I had some fragmentation wounds. I guess the most immediately life-threatening for me was I got a nick in the side of my neck from a piece of fragmentation, which nicked my artery, and I had a within a few minutes sort of had a grapefruit-sized lump in the side of my neck, and they were really worried that was going to cut off the blood supply to my brain. So that got me. When I was first operated on in Baghdad, that's what they were working to fix or prevent. But I also, I guess, in longer term, more dangerous injury for me was I had fragmentation wounds into basically the bridge of my nose and along my eyebrow line. The one in the bridge of my nose, the fragmentation actually fractured the bone in between my sinus and my brain, and they were quite worried about getting infection into my brain from that. But luckily that never played out. But yeah, sort of, you know, for me, it's something, you know, I was, I guess, to think back, I was quite stoic about it. There was nothing I could do about it, so I got on with it. The biggest issues, I think, were from my wife and my family having to live with that, the prognosis and the unknown condition that I would end up in, whether this would be serious permanent injuries or something I would recover from. And again, luckily, I've got a few little quirks, but there's nothing which slows me down from that those injuries.
And you didn't actually then repatriate yourself out of the armed forces. You returned to Baghdad 2 years later in 2006. You were at operating at a higher level, and you had more responsibility. So there's a number of questions I want to ask, but I'm interested in what changes you'd observed in the city in the period between your first deployment and injury and your return in 2006. So how had the first deployment and your injury and subsequent time away from the war zone shaped your leadership insights as you re-entered that zone 2 years later?
I guess from an environment perspective, Baghdad had actually changed significantly. As I said at the start, it was in 2004. It was a capital city, the capital city of Iraq, which was a functioning capital city, and people, you know, the 7 million occupants were all just trying to get on with their lives. When I went back in 2006, that had changed. So about 1 million people had fled the city, and I got the feeling that it was really a city under siege. They'd been at they had hundreds of thousands of coalition forces in the country. They had, Sunni Shia ongoing violence, which was widespread and deadly. They were getting fed, the Shia in particular, getting fed some very sophisticated weapons out of Iran. There was this real lawlessness and disorder created by, they talked about the de-Ba'athification, so the removal of the leadership of the country who were affiliated with Saddam Hussein. So it was a country which really was struggling to keep. In fact, they weren't keeping things under control. And people really, like I said, you know, they were living in siege-like conditions. They really didn't want to leave their house unless they absolutely had to. So it was quite tragic to see that change, but it was, in other ways, it was kind of inevitable. To answer your question about, I guess, what I'd seen in the leadership piece, I said earlier that we were operating at what I'd considered a high risk or even an extreme risk level back in 2004. And this is, I don't say that in a way that I'm having a gripe of anyone in the command structure. It's just the way we were operating back then, we were maturing as an organisation. Australia hadn't operated in an area like that probably since Somalia, and then before that, Vietnam. We were really just coming to terms with the way we were operating. There wasn't a risk culture, And whilst I felt we were operating at a very high risk in 2004, when I went back in 2006, there'd been a lot of things put in place to control those risks. So we'd moved outside what they called the red zone, which was out basically living amongst the population. We'd moved into a large US base in an area called the International Zone, which is basically just a walled-off portion of the city where entry and exit was highly controlled, and it meant you're a lot safer from things like bombs and shootings. So that in a lot of ways controlled the risk, but I guess more so, whilst in 2004 my guys had been out on the road all day, every day, in 2006 to go out on the road to leave the International Zone was required a deliberate planning activity. So we would look at all aspects of that task, reviewing it for, you know, the necessity of it, why we were doing it, but also then considering what the enemy trends were, the locations we were going to, how long we'll be there, the routes we could use, the formations we could use, all these ended up being extremely complex planning tasks just to leave, just to carry out our function of escorting the diplomats around the city. And what that means is we could minimise and control the risk down to the lowest possible level. And again, that was, for me, that was an incredible insight into developing a risk culture and risk management, because that's exactly what we're doing.
And that, of course, plays out in the next step you took into a further deployment, this time in Afghanistan. I understand this was driven by your experience of the growing threat that technically advanced enemy improvised explosive devices posed, and other such items posed to the safety and security of our forces. So can you talk about the deployment in Afghanistan and all of the learnings that you brought through from your lived experience as in two deployments in Iraq?
And it was one of those opportunities that, you know, it doesn't happen that often in your life, but it probably gets said too often. It was just one of those things I could not, you know, when the opportunity came up, it was a deployment I couldn't say no to. I guess the previous two deployments, I'd been young and excited about the adventure of going overseas. At this stage, I was in my early 30s. I had a young daughter. I really wasn't. The excitement of deploying overseas had kind of left me. But I had moved on from those two tasks in Baghdad. I'd spent a lot of time training soldiers about to go overseas to Iraq, and I had worked in the strategic realm, the counter ID realm. So looking at what training the Defence Force needed to do to minimise the chance of getting injured, what equipment we could bring into service to best protect our people, and how we shift the thinking around how we protect ourselves. And at that stage, I'd also got this incredible insight into what they call technical intelligence. So understanding how bombs are put together, understanding how you can learn so much about a bomb maker and a insurgent bomb in placer by using techniques which were first adopted really by the FBI in the US, tracking down serial killers, which sounds crazy, but that's in essence what they were. If you start understanding people's movements and you understand their routine and understand for insurgent bomb makers, understand their supply chain, so understand where they get their equipment from, suddenly it really narrows down the group of people who you're looking at. So I got an insight into that, and then this opportunity came up to run what they call a weapons intelligence team in Afghanistan, which was going out doing post-blast analysis from bomb blasts, reverse engineering what was left behind to understand everything about the device, but then more so understand, you know, what the insurgent was trying to achieve with the bomb, what the victims or the whoever the targets were at that bomb, what they were doing, what the components were and what we knew about those components, even down to biometrics, what fingerprints had been left on it, things like that, and then feeding that into the broader intelligence picture. And, you know, suddenly if you overlay everything else you understand about that patch of dirt and about that fingerprint and about the component, suddenly you get really smart really quickly about these insurgent bomb makers. So I did that work, which was truly extraordinary work, and I feel really privileged for being able to do that. I guess one of the challenges for me was it was really early days of this capability in the Australian Defence Force. The US and the UK had been doing it a bit longer than us. You know, the UK had understood this from years fighting the IRA, who did use improvised explosive devices. So they'd really got smart about this. The US had really picked up on it during Iraq, and Australia had really seen a few incidents which indicated that we really needed to get smart about it if we're going to do everything we possibly can to protect our people. Like I said, it was early days of this capability. So a lot of what I was doing was getting the commanders who we were supporting, the guys who were operating out in the field, to understand why, you know, when a bomb went off, the next thing they're going to see is me and my team getting helicoptered in, why they need to spend an extra 2 hours there, you know, creating, you know, leaving themselves vulnerable to further attack so we can do that post-blast work, and then being able to take what we learn about the device and tell them what the enemy's using against them and helping them work out tactics and things like that. So it was a fantastic opportunity. And I honestly, you know, whilst I wasn't that excited about deploying at the end of the 9 months over there, me and my small team of four of us, we left very comfortably knowing that we'd, you know, had the privilege of saving lives, be it coalition lives and Australian lives, but also local Afghan lives as well. So it was really quite an amazing experience.
So that's a legacy that you've left that keeps paying forward as people in the future build on that knowledge base.
Yeah, and I still every now and then to get asked to come in and speak to defence groups about, even the intelligence community, about the genesis of the technical intelligence within the Defence Force, and say, you know, here's where we were, here's what we knew, here were the challenges that we faced, and here's how we overcame them. So, yeah, absolutely.
So it's interesting, you made a decision to leave the regular armed forces after your Afghanistan deployment, having served for 20 years. I'm interested to understand what drove your decision to pivot, and where did you decide to take your leadership career, and did you have a transition plan?
Yeah, good question. So I guess, first of all, the reasons, there were plenty of reasons for me to leave. I love the role. I love being in defence. But at that stage, I then had two children, two little girls. I've got a third now, but at that stage, I had two little girls, and my eldest, Eva, was five. She'd moved house five times, and I'd been away for years of her life. And it just wasn't. It wasn't fair on her, on my wife, and I didn't want to do that with Zoe as well, my second daughter. And so that was somewhat easy. And I guess the other piece as well was that defence has, particularly the Army, has pretty clearly defined career paths. And you do a minimum time in rank before you can move on to the next rank and get more responsibility. And I started to get a feeling that I was a passenger in my own career, which didn't really sit well with me. So they were probably the two big reasons for me to leave. Your second point about my career plan, my transition plan, I'll be honest with you, I sometimes feel like I'm that example of what not to do in your career. I And I went on to work in the veteran employment transition space after this, but a lot of it was because I'd made so many silly decisions myself. I was finishing off a bit of uni work, had a few subjects to do. I had a lot of long service leave up my sleeve, and I thought, I'll cut here. Well, we'll move we had a house down on the south coast in New South Wales. We'll move down there. I'll spend 6 months finishing off a bit of study and working out where I'm going to be in the world, have a bit of relax from coming from some really high-tempo jobs, you know, spend a bit more time with the kids and, yeah, just take it step by step. So the way that played out was I spent about 2 weeks in my back room tapping away on the computer, going slightly stir-crazy, going from this high-tempo job to the listening to the crickets chirp, basically. And not only that, because I didn't have a plan of what I was going to do next, rather enjoy this period of long service leave that I had, I spent the entire time worrying about what the job I was going to be doing at the end of it all. It all fell into place, as things have a tendency to do. But there were times where I was just really all consumed by this dread of what have I done? And what am I going to be doing next? So, yeah, like I said, I often use it as here are the lessons I learned from doing it all wrong.
So at the end of our conversation today, I hope you'll share some of those valuable lessons.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So you mentioned that you did some work for the New South Wales government in the Veterans Employment Program. What did that involve?
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I left defence, and when one thing which became really apparent to me when I started looking for jobs was that civilian employers really had very little understanding of the military, what they do. You know, there's in a lot of, and I don't want to generalise too much, but there seems to be this very stereotypical idea of what a military person is. You know, they're angry and they yell and they're good at marching around with a pack on their back, and they're, you know, honestly, I think a lot of people think you're a bit of a knucklehead. No understanding of the breadth of sort of academic training you have, just as much as any other training. You know, I spoke about those complex planning activities, and I was a relatively junior officer, and I'd been through years of formal leadership training as well as informal mentoring throughout my entire career. And employers didn't see that. And not only that, I saw some really high-caliber military people of all ranks really struggle to find jobs. And I thought that was, you know, it really grated on me. So I started making noises about that. And when my book came out, that was sort of one of the key things that I'd push around, you know, take that leap of faith, get an ex-military person in for an interview. That's how you can support the veteran community, by assisting them get jobs. Whilst I was making that noise, one of the New South Wales government, he was the chief of staff for the Minister for Veterans in New South Wales, rang me up out of the blue and said, hey, you're making a lot of noise about veteran employment. We've got a role starting, standing up and leading a veteran employment program in New South Wales government. Why don't you put your money where your mouth is and apply for the job, which I did, and I was selected. And it was fantastic, you know. So we really operated in two parts. So the first was assisting military people, and it was all about getting jobs in New South Wales government. So it was getting them to understand, right, the range of jobs that were out there, the help them translate their skills, get them to understand some of the quirks, and to be frank, there are quirks in the recruitment process in government jobs. You know, you need to understand the transparency of the process, so you don't inadvertently disadvantage yourself in that process. So there's a lot on that side, but I actually think where I spent most of my time and where I think I had the best impact was getting in the face of potential employers. So at the higher level leadership areas, the departmental secretaries and DEPSECs, and then recruitment managers, and getting them to understand what the typical person from the military is, what their training's been, helping them to understand the military rank structure and what a person of a certain rank brings to the party, and also what the equivalent is in New South Wales government to what a rank is in the military. So if you talk about, if I'm talking to a secretary or a deputy secretary, I'm saying, you have equivalent responsibility to a general in the military, which often departmental secretaries really liked hearing. But you work at a strategic level. You take decisions from government and you turn them into policy and you enact them on the ground. You know, the generals do the same thing. You resource it, you make sure it's appropriate, sustainable, and you execute it, basically. You make it happen. All the way down to, what a mid-ranking junior officer does, how that relates to a public sector role, what a warrant officer, a non-commissioned officer, what their job's like, this leadership, this being able to, run large groups, understand strategy and operationalise on the ground, and then talk about soldiers and the skills, your average, four to six year soldier would have, and how transferable those skills are to government. So I think that second point about engaging with employers in government, and I was lucky, I got to expand that and talk to a lot in the private sector as well, and I think that got a lot more traction than anything else, because there is, we are, as a society, we are shaped by Hollywood and shaped by the media in what we think a military person is, and generally it's not quite right.
And, only someone who is in the military can bridge that gap, because it's the inside understanding of the value of all of that and how it translates in the layperson's, the civilian's world. You don't know what you don't know. And so...
It's something that took me years to understand. So it's only fair that somebody not in defence doesn't understand it. Mm.
And what I'm interested now in talking to you about is this wonderful organisation, this company that you founded. Everything has been wrapped up into developing a leadership experience that is all about, assessing, recognising and preparing for mitigating risk. Can you talk about Trebuchet Pivot and, the work that you do?
Yeah, and you've said it beautifully. I said I did a bit of work when I was in defence training leadership teams, and I ended up doing that as my normal day-to-day job, but then also got posted for a few years where I was specifically doing the final training of leadership teams before they went to Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was an incredible experience because I got I got to impart the lessons which I'd learned on these people, but also I got to see all these leadership teams in defence come together, and we threw every conceivable scenario at them to help them, and there was an aspect of mentoring through this as well to help them come together as a leadership team to make decisions under duress, basically. And we got to see guys do it really well. So, leadership groups come together and just smash it and have these streamlined decision-making processes for when it all went bad. And to be fair, we also saw the other end of the spectrum as well. Teams come in which needed more work, which needed that mentoring, which needed assistance, and we had to build them up to get ready for the war zone. I went away from that posting with all this knowledge of what makes a great leadership team in a crisis. And it took me a few years working in the private sector and then in the public sector to see how I could use this in organisational leadership, be it private sector or public sector. And so I... Really, it's I developed these processes, and like I said, it's really all about identifying and pulling apart what your risks are, linking that to your overarching strategy. And I think that's for a lot of organisations, they grapple with that. And I like to work at the board level because you can set the strategy. Once they understand how risk processes work with them, they're great at setting their risk tolerances, which then drive the strategy of the organisation. But I guess the other half, and the piece which I'm really interested in, is the piece of risk which is not talked about very much, which is what happens when you have all these risk processes, you believe you controlled all your risks, but just like today in this COVID environment, you have multiple risks which are realised at once and all, you know, overlaying on top of each other. So if you were going to do a clinical risk management process with it, you'd have, you know, these extreme risks which businesses haven't prepared for. And it's giving these leadership teams, these corporate leadership teams, the skills to pull apart a problem, to break it down into its core pieces, to be able to scenario plan what might be happening into the future, understanding what's likely going to occur, understand what's the worst case for the organisation, and then develop some strategic objectives to work towards to avoid those things playing out, and then being able to devise action plans and engage with stakeholders and things like that. So it's lovely to be able to take all those military skills and experience and be able to plug them into corporate Australia, really, for the benefit of leaders being able to stick their hand up and say, yes, I'm prepared. I know the processes. My team understands how we can best protect our organisation when it all starts falling apart.
They're really powerful inputs you bring to the corporate sector, I guess, with COVID and with this very, very uncertain world that we live in, with many changes, both, you know, political, environmental, etc. There's a lot more complexity around scenario planning and risk managing than there ever was before.
Yeah, there is, and I'm seeing it more and more. I think a lot of the traditional thinking around risk is around financial risk, and you see it so much now. Still, you know, you go to an organisation, you want to talk to, you know, the board's or the organisation's risk committee, and they go, hey, the audit and risk committee or the finance and risk committee. And that's a really interesting observation I've made over the years, which is audit and risk, having the same people in the room, it generally means that they're all people with that finance background. So they're not necessarily a particularly diverse group. And I believe the best way to develop your risk process is by tapping into a broader diverse group as you possibly can. Cognitive diversity is the way you protect your organisation. Getting input from groups of people who all think differently is the best way to understand. You know, if you're developing scenarios, that's what you want. You want people who come in with a different background, with different viewpoints, and then that shows you what you might be facing. Whereas, yeah, like I said, that it appears to be changing now. People are starting to understand that. You know, risk isn't the realm just of the finance people. It's now those. Well, I'd love to see that when you talk about risk, it's the board and its entirety come together and discuss that and bring in those subject matter experts, which can grow and build on the diversity which they've identified they're lacking within their group.
Garth, if I were to ask you to share your top five takeaways for people on leadership journeys who are listening to this podcast, what would your top five be?
Yeah, okay. I guess that, you know, number one for me would be, you know, to be a great leader, you need to invest in yourself and never stop learning and never stop moving forward. The amount of fantastic leadership stuff which is out there on YouTube is just incredible. You know, the Simon Sinek's of the world and guys like that got some really great insights which you can pull apart. But also, you know, spend some money yourself. Go and, you know, go and do some university courses, get a diploma, whatever it is, even if it's not leadership specific. Second would be to get serious about EQ. So get serious about emotional intelligence. To be a great leader, you need to have great emotional intelligence. I think that's pretty well acknowledged these days. Unless you can work with empathy and compassion, you are not going to be able to effectively lead, simply. Understand real risk, I think, would be my third. So, you know, again, my exposure and my experiences in Baghdad in 2004, it's not the way I recommend that other people get this experience, but maybe, again, learn from my experiences. Risk, real risk, always comes back to people. At the end of the day, no matter what the outcomes is, no matter what the risk category you're working in, the end results will be how they affect people. If it's an impact on finances, it will increase stress at work. It will mean that people will lose jobs. It means that people, the organisation will struggle and keep increased stress. If you're looking at say supply chain risks, again, it will impact on the business operations. It will impact on people at the end, stakeholders losing confidence in the organisation, consumers not being able to get whatever it is that you provide. Number four, and I don't want to sound too much like I'm plugging the business here, but I think a great leader needs to understand how to make decisions under duress. I think COVID has shown us that being a great CEO during a period of business as usual activity doesn't mean you're going to be a great CEO to pivot the organisation, to best protect the organisation and to capitalise on the opportunities that presents. And then the last one, you know, number five for me, and the front page of The Australian or The Sydney Morning Herald or The Age will show this pretty much every day, is that as a leader, you need to calibrate your moral compass and keep it calibrated, making sure you don't do things which are unpalatable in society these days, you know, morally corrupt or reprehensible, or even, you know, even those things which are walking the line of being legal and the regulator coming after you. So, yeah, can't say that enough. Making sure you are the right role model by keeping and leading the business the right way.
They are five excellent leadership takeaways. Thank you so much, Garth. And what a way to wrap up our conversation today. Garth, thank you for being so generous with your insights into leadership today and for sharing your very personal experiences of active service in our armed forces. Your book, After the Blast, is a brilliant read, and you have a website for listeners interested in your leadership company, Trebuchet Pivot. Links to these will be in the show notes at whatleadersknow.com. And Garth, I just want to say again, thank you.
Thanks, Penny. It's been my privilege.
If you would like a resource to prompt you to stretch your change muscle, or if you're looking for support to take your career to the next level, head on over to my website, whatleadersknow.com, where you'll be able to download the resource along with show notes from this episode. I look forward to your company next week. Until then, happy days and stay safe. I'm Penny Beeston, and this has been What Leaders Know.